Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We are studying this morning Perashat Pinchas. Today's shiur will be studied in Fuas Shelema Esther Mazal Haya Bat Liza Garaz. Ruf Baruch Hu Shishander and Fuas Shelema Betuch Sha'ar Chodei Yisrael. Amen. Perashat Pinchas, the Perashat that we read this Shabbat, is actually a sequel from an episode that began last week, towards the end of our Perashah. In last week's Perashah, at the end of Balak, we read about the sinister plot of Bilam, who was unsuccessful at cursing the Jewish people, but was successful at entrapping them into committing acts of promiscuity and lewdness. He set up a situation where the girls of Midian, the non-Jewish girls, enticed the Jewish men into sin, and that was premeditated, that was Bilam's idea, in order to let the Jewish people succumb to their yetzer hara, to their passion. As a result of it, God was furious with his nation. It seems that God has tolerance for different sins, but when it comes to sins in the realm of immodesty, whether it's immodesty of men or whether it's the immodesty of women, it seems God's level of tolerance or patience runs very thin when it comes to these sins. As a result, there was a plague that ensued, and 24,000 Jews died. That's a catastrophe of the highest proportion. I want you to keep in mind that when the Jewish people worshipped the golden calf, which was also a miserable event in our history, that was idolatry. There were 3,000 casualties. It just goes to show you that God even has a higher tolerance towards Avodah Zarah, to idolatry, than he has to immodesty. Where almost 10 times the amount of people died as a result of the sin of the daughters of Midian being with the Jewish men, then of the egel itself, of the golden calf. The sin was so terrible that even one of the tribal leaders, a fellow by the name of Zimri, he was a Jewish man, he was supposedly a leader of Israel. He was a leader of the tribe of Shimon. He also got involved in the sin. Torah tells us he took one of the princesses of Midian, a lady by the name of Kozbi Batsur, and he committed the sin with her in the public domain. And that only infuriated God that much more so. That's all in last week's Perashah. And then at the end it tells us about a man by the name of Pinchas. He was a grandson of Aharon. He went on his own in an act of zealotry. He took his romah, his spear in his hand, and he went in the middle of the camp in front of everybody. While Zimri was committing the sin, together with Kozbi, and he took the spear and he thrusted it through the both of them, and he killed them both simultaneously. And the Perashah ends with two words. Actually, the episode ends with two words. Vate'atzar ha-magefa. And the plague stopped. Once Pinchas did what he did, which means he protested what happened in such a way, God saw Pinchas' action And God was happy with what Pinhas did. Nobody should think, Chas v'Shalom, that Pinhas was a religious maniac. Nobody should think that Pinhas lacked discipline, that he was just an extremist. He saw somebody committing a sin, so he took out his spear and he laced into both of them. Chas v'Shalom. Pinhas was a rational man. He was a peaceful man. But he was following Jewish law. Jewish halakha demands that if somebody does such a practice, then the zealots are able to take revenge. What does a zealot mean? Somebody that has no ulterior motive, that is 100% l'shem shamayim, that is attacking the evil because it's evil, not because of any personal grudges or ulterior motive. It has to be 1,010% pure in order to do such a thing. That's why today we have no zealots. Today religious zealotry doesn't exist. Because who could say that they're 100% pure without any bad intention mixed in, that they could do such things, l'shem shamayim? Let me explain to you that even if you're 99.99999% l'shem shamayim, if there's a percentage of a point where it's not, that act is considered murderous. We don't believe you could just kill. Unless there's a situation like this where Zimri is committing a sin in public with a goya, if you could say that you're 100% l'shem shamayim, then you could take the law of the Torah into your own hands. Pinhas was the exception. Pinhas was that one man that was so pure that he only was filled with love of God. And that's what drove him to do what he did. And the Torah testifies, Pinhas was emet. Pinhas was truthful. His zealotry was the right kind of zealotry. It wasn't extremism. It wasn't done out of haste. It was actually a commendable act. So much so that in this week's Parashah, Pinhas gets rewarded for what he did. What was the reward that God gave Pinhas? He said, for doing this, for avenging my anger, for fighting those that fought against God, Pinhas, you now are going to receive an upgrade in level. How did God upgrade Pinhas? He turned him into a Kohen. He gave him the status of a Kohen. Wasn't he a Kohen already? After all, he was the grandson of Aharon. And our rabbis tell us that when Aharon was nominated to be the Kohen, he was nominated along with his four children. Aharon had four sons. Nadab, Abihu, Elazar, Itamar. Four sons and him, they became the five Kohanim of the world. And any future descendant of the four children of Aharon also were given Kehunah. Pinhas, who was a grandson of Aharon, was alive already when that was given. Any descendants of Aharon that were alive did not qualify for Kehunah. It was only future descendants that were not born yet. Since Pinhas was alive, he wasn't part of it. But Pinhas earned Kehunah after he did this act. So I once heard an explanation. Why wasn't the whole family of Aharon included in Kehunah? Why did God box out some of the family? People that were born already, they didn't become Kohanim. Only Aharon, his four sons, and whoever's going to be subsequently born after that, they became Kohanim. So Pinhas was boxed out. He was born already. Why would God do it that way? I heard an explanation recently. There was a claim against the family of Aharon. Do you remember Aharon? his role in the golden calf. The people came to Aaron and they said, Moshe Rabbeinu is not returning. We want a replacement. We want a golden calf. What was Aaron's reaction? He tried to negotiate with them. He tried to pacify them. He tried to slow them down. He said, okay, we'll do the egg. We'll just go get some jewelry, bring it back. He figured by the time they get the jewelry from their wives and they return with it, they melt it down, by then Moshe Rabbeinu will return anyway. So he was just trying to delay them and stall them. Aaron in his wildest dreams never dreamt that they're going to come back with the jewelry in record time and take their own jewelry, melt it down, and before he knew it, there was an egel frolicking in the middle of the camp. In retrospect, you know what Aaron should have done, maybe? Instead of trying to pacify the sinners, instead of trying to negotiate with terrorists, Aaron should have made a very strong protest and say, impossible, it's haram, it cannot be done, it will not be tolerated. This is a grave sin, I cannot sanction it. But Aaron, who is by nature a man of peace, he didn't absolutely, with full strength of conviction, absolutely tell them no. Of course, his intention was no. Don't get me wrong, Aaron did not want this to happen. Aaron's whole plan was to delay them. But that was a claim against Aaron. You didn't protest this. You gave them more rope. You gave them a chance to succeed. You should have flat out rejected their plan. And that's why when God gave the kehunah to Aaron's family, He said, I can't give it to the entire family. You'll get it, your children will get it, your future descendants will get it, but the kehunah is limited. When did the kehunah of Aaron's family now become expanded, even to other members? When the sin of Aaron was fixed. When was the sin of Aaron fixed? When Pinehas stood up against Zimri. When he saw somebody committing a crime and such, Pinehas didn't go to Zimri and say, please, Nochi, you're making a sin. It's not right. Think about what you're doing. He didn't negotiate with such a sinner. Pinehas went and said, what my grandfather didn't do at the Egan, now I'm going to do. I'm not going to pacify these people. I must make a stand to fight against them so it doesn't spread. They must learn the tough way, the word of God. At that moment, Pinehas fixed, so to speak, the passiveness of Aaron at the time of Egel. It seems that there are certain situations where the Torah demands from its leaders to make protests, to stand up for what is right. It seems that our Torah demands from its leaders to sometimes do things that are unpopular. But at the end of the day, after Pinehas did what he did, he saved the day. The plague stopped. You understand that if he wouldn't have done this, the plague would have been not 24,000, it could have been 240,000. It could have been 2 million, God forbid. This was open-ended. God did not have any intent to stop the plague. It was 24,000, it was still moving, it was still rolling. When Pinehas did this act, he said, oh, there's somebody that's fighting for the right way. There's somebody that's fighting for the Torah. God said, the plague stops now. Pinehas, in effect, saved Am Yisrael from destruction. But what was the reaction of the people after Pinehas did what he did? How do you think they would have reacted? I would guess that they would react and make Pinchas a national hero. You did it! You saved us! If it was me, I would propose to make one day a year, Pinchas Day. Look what he did. He saved the nation from destruction. I would make a testimonial dinner for him, publish a journal, give him a trophy. You know what the reaction of the people was to Pinchas's zealotry? Who does he think he is? He's going to do zealotry. Do you know who his grandfather is? What do you mean his grandfather's Aaron? No, that's his father's side. But you know who his mother's side is? You know who his maternal grandfather is? The people started to say, Yitro. Yitro was a convert. Yitro originally was a Gentile. Yitro used to worship idolatry. So you know what the people said? Oh, look at his Pinchas. Who does he think he is? His grandfather was a priest. And he's going to come now holier than thou. A descendant of converts, and he's going to start making zealotry and killing and doing. You know what I learned from here? You can never please people. No matter what you're going to do, you could save the world. And there's always going to be naysayers that say, who does he think he is? You'll work on committees for institutions. You'll raise money for charity. You'll make classes of Torah. You'll perpetuate chesed. And then you'll think that somebody will come and pat you on the back and say, good work, we're proud of you. But you have to know that human nature is that not everybody has the ability to do that. The nature will be, yeah, it's a very nice thing, but he's not the one to do it. Who does he think he is? I remember what he was. I know who his father was. All of a sudden now he thinks he's gonna do something like this. People cannot leave well alone, well enough alone. They have to knock him, they have to criticize. Instead of telling Pinchas, Hazak Baruch, to scale him, Mitzvah, you're a great guy. Where'd you muster up all that courage to do this? You're great. Unfortunately, the nature of people is, maybe it's envy, maybe it's jealousy, maybe they can't see somebody else enjoying center stage, or anybody accomplishing something that maybe they feel guilty that they didn't accomplish. So if you're working for the community, this should be consoling to you. Then don't think you're any different than Pinchas. You'll do great things in your life, and there'll always be somebody that's badgering and criticizing and naysaying on the side saying, who does she think she is? You'll feel good about yourself until somebody will come along and say, she has no right. Yeah, it's a nice thing that she did, but she's not the one to do it. It's not proper. We have to protect ourselves from this. When you see people doing great things and accomplishing, control that nature to knock. Control that nature to find fault. B'nai Yisrael, they reacted incorrectly to Pinchas. So the Torah tells us, God came to the protection of Pinchas. And he made a pirasha in his name. God says, I'll make him the testimonial. The honor that he didn't receive from people, he received from God. Every year we read a pirasha, Pinchas. And it's named after him. And the first pisukim in the pirasha tell us in the name of God, Pinchas is great. I'm upgrading him to a Kohen. His family is going to enjoy a peace covenant with me. When the people saw all the accolades that God said to Pinchas, said, okay, we accept, we take it back, he's a good guy. But I once heard a question. What motivated Pinchas to do what he did? What inspired him? I mean, it takes an act of courage to do such a thing. Where did he get his motivation from? And one of the rabbis explained, you know who motivated Phinehas? Ironically, Zimri. What? The sin maker inspired the mitzvah maker? How is that possible? Hachamim tell us that sin makers have a great ability to inspire good people. How? When we see the enthusiasm and the devotion that they have for their evil, we could learn from them how devoted we have to be to our religion. We could learn from the evil of the passion that they have, how unlazy they are when they're involved in their frivolity and their trivial things. The religious can learn from those that are not. When you see how devoted they are to their shtuyot, to their stupidity, you must think to yourself that they can be so loyal to nothingness. We shouldn't have the same loyalty to the truth. We shouldn't be as committed as to God as they are as to their nothingness. Hence, the evildoers can be a source of inspiration to the good people. I was recently on the train in New York, and usually I take the train against rush hour, so there's not too many people on the train with me. But I happened to sit next to a fellow that was talking to his friend. And he was boasting how every morning for years he wakes up at 5 o'clock in the morning. So it caught my attention, because waking up is something noble, early in the morning, an early riser. So I caught my attention. What does he do? What is he involved in that he wakes up for so many years at 5 in the morning? So he says he has a ritual. He doesn't have to be in work till 9. But he gets up 5 o'clock in the morning and he goes upstairs to his computer and he's part of a poker tournament where they play poker throughout the world, where you somehow you get into the game. And from 5 to 8, he plays 3 hours of poker and he smokes a few cigarettes and he unwinds. At 8 o'clock he goes downstairs to take a shower. At 9 o'clock he goes to work. And I couldn't help think to myself, you know, we have to get up 40 days a year to be in synagogue at 5 a.m. Those are the 40 days before Kippur. Sephardim have a custom to read Selichot, special prayer. And it's so difficult, because to be in synagogue at 5, you have to be up at 4:30. And you have to prepare, and you have to be up. And I said to myself, if this guy can get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to play poker on a computer and smoke a cigarette, nothingness, vanity, waste of time, I cannot be as passionate to the truth. I cannot be as passionate to my religion as this guy. He should have more devotion to a game of poker than I should have to synagogue. He should be more committed to a cigarette than I should be to Torah mitzvot. I felt that God made me hear this man talk in order that I should be motivated to do more. If he could commit to nothing, then I'm not doing enough. Little did that man know that he inspired me. And the next morning when I got up to synagogue, I couldn't help but have that idea cross my mind. Look what I'm getting up for. To talk to my Creator. To do mitzvot. To motivate people in the study of Talmud. And I was thinking, where is that fellow now? He's also up. He's also excited. His adrenaline is also flowing. Dealing. Upping the ante. Shaking the ashes off his cigarette. And I said to myself, this man motivated me. And that's who motivated Pinchas as well. He said, if Zimri has such passion that he can go in front of everybody, take a goya, he doesn't care, he's not interested in what they have to say, he's not interested in peer pressure or public opinion, he's doing it because he's committed to his passion, I can be committed to God just the same. I don't care what people are going to say, I don't care if it takes a certain amount of courage. And he went and killed Zimri. On whose credit? Zimri's credit. Thank you, Zimri, for inspiring Pinchas. He evoked the positive reaction in Pinchas. And maybe that's what the Pasuk means. When it says, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, Heshiv et Hamati me'al b'nei Yisrael. God says, Pinchas avenged my anger, Bekanoi Kenati, when he committed that act of zealotry, Betocham. What does the word Betocham mean? Betocham means in their midst. The Torah is telling you, where did Pinchas get the strength to do what he did? Who catalyzed Pinchas for that act? Betocham, from them, from the evildoers themselves. Betochan is telling us where Pinchas got his inspiration. It was Betochan, it was from them. Who's from them? From the sinners. But in our generation, we could learn from the Betochan, from those that are around us. To the addict that will go to the end of the world to fulfill an addiction. Or to a businessman that will travel to a different time zone and live in very small quarters in a hotel room and eat tuna fish for weeks at a time in order to make money. If a businessman can sacrifice hours on a plane and a limited diet and not the best accommodations to make money, that teaches me that I can also limit my luxury in order to study and teach. I also can sacrifice some of the amenities of life in order to be religious. Everybody sacrifices in life. Everybody gives up something. But the question is, what are they giving it up for? Most people sacrifice for things that are not worth it. The things that don't really mean anything in the scope of life. These books over here, ladies, represent eternity. These books over here are never ending. They represent our ticket to the eternal world, Olam Haba, which exists forever. Therefore, there can be nothing more important than this. Everything has an expiration to it. Everything has an end. Everything has a finish line. Only religion, Judaism, Torah, Mitzvot is eternal. If you can wake up at 5 in the morning to play checkers, that is here today and gone the next minute. I say that because my rabbi once told me that he walked through the Arab Souk once in Israel. Today, of course, nobody would dare to walk through the Arab market. But then when it was acceptable to walk through the Shuk as you make your way to the western wall, to the court end. So he also rose as an early riser. The rabbi was walking through and he saw two Arab merchants sitting in front of their store shop playing tole at 5 o'clock in the morning. And the rabbi said to himself, they got up at 5 o'clock and have nothing to do already? Tole, usually you do at the end of the day, after you did everything and you finished everything and you accomplished all the important things. But the first thing in the morning already, you're shooting dice at a backgammon contest. He says, look at the difference. I'm on my way to the courtyard to serve God. So he said, I learned from them. If they can get up at 5 a.m. to play backgammon, that demands from me to be at least as serious in my studies. That should be an inspiration to you ladies as well. Unfortunately, we see a great commitment on our society today to immodest fashion. And I believe it's a sacrifice for these ladies. Because it is my belief that by nature, ladies are modest. That is the innate nature of a woman, to be modest. That's a default system. Every lady is born with that system. The Gemara says this. Why? Because a lady was created from the limb of man, from one of the ribs. The ribs of Adam are hidden, they're concealed, they're covered. So the essence of a woman was created from modesty. It wasn't from an exposed limb of Adam. It was from a covered limb, a limb that's underneath. And therefore the Gemara says it is the nature of woman by default, just by being born, they're automatically modest. Everyone. But today we see a tremendous sacrifice that ladies are willing to go against their nature to break a normal habit in order to be immodest. It's a tremendous sacrifice. It always wondered and bothered me. But now I understand. We see a lady that's dressed immodestly, so wearing something that's short. And you see them always pulling their skirt down. Why? Or covering themselves. Why? You're uncovered already. Why are you covered? Because that's the natural nature to be covered. And that's why they're always trying to cover themselves more. So then what are you doing dressed like that? I'm sacrificing for immodesty. I'm sacrificing against my nature to be immodest, because that's the fashion. For fashion, I'm willing to go against my nature. I'm willing to do something that's against my natural nature, against my better judgment. I'm willing to be uncomfortable for the sake of immodesty. And I say to the modest ladies, which you all are modest, God bless you all, we must learn from that sacrifice. If they can sacrifice against their nature to be immodest, we must have the same passion and strength and devotion and commitment to dress according to your nature. Technically, it should be easier for us than for them. But if they're willing to sacrifice everything to wear clothes today, that are so provocative, that woman would not have dreamt to wear such clothes just a few years ago. But because of the winds of culture and society, and because of pressure, women are able to do things far and beyond their better judgment. So we should learn from them that if they can sacrifice all their values and all their morals and all that they know is right, if they could sacrifice it all to be mascots of the fashion world, so that we could be just as loyal to the fashion that has been dictated by our Torah. The inspiration of Pinhas comes from Zimri. The inspiration of good comes from evil. And therefore you can learn from everybody, like the Mishnah says, Ezil Chacham, who's a wise man, Halomed Mikol Adam, somebody that can learn from everybody. Even from people that were not planning on teaching you anything. But you can learn from them anyway. They have no intention. You think somebody had intention to teach Pinhas? Of course not. As a result, Pinhas killed him. But we can learn from them nonetheless. Mitocham, from them. The Torah continues in our parasha. The Torah tells us about the families of the Jewish nation. In our parasha, there's a census that was held. Each family was accounted for, and the Torah gives us the precise numbers of each family. And then the Torah gives us the sum total, which comes close to 600,000. And one of the families that we're all familiar with is the Levi family. The Levi family is actually one of the most prestigious families in Am Yisrael. Till today, if a person has the zechut that his last name is Levi, or he can descend from the Levi family, some from the most noble families. Shevet Levi, that's the family of the Kohanim as well. One of the most important tribes. And the Torah tells us, of course, the founder of the Levi family was Levi himself, the son of Jacob, the son of Yaakov. Levi himself had three children. Gereshon, Kehat, and Merari. Kehat, which is a son of Levi, had a son called Amram. Amram became the father of Moshe and Aaron. So the Torah is giving us the lineage. And Levi, his son Kehat, his son Amram, his son Moshe. It's giving us the lineage. But all of a sudden, in the middle of the lineage of the men, the Torah pauses and gives us one pasuk of honorable mention about a lady. If you look at all the families, all men are mentioned, no ladies. You get to this pasuk, they give honorable mention to who? To Yocheved. V'shem Eshet Amram Yocheved Bat Nevi Asher Yalda Ota Nevi B'Misraim Batele Le'Amram Et Aharon Ve'et Moshe Ve'et Miriam Achotam. The Torah places Yocheved at the core of the genealogy of the family of Levi. What is so special about this lady Yocheved? Who was she? Well, we know she married Amram. And we know she became the mother of Moshe and Aaron and Miriam. Our rabbis tell us that Yocheved lived a very long life. She lived at least 250 years. She was actually born right when the Jews came down to Egypt. And we know we stayed in Egypt for 210 years. And she came out with us. And she lived in the desert for 40 years. So she had to be at least 250 years old. I don't know of a more lucky lady that ever lived in our history. Could you imagine Yocheved? She was able to see three of her children become from the greatest members of our people. I cannot imagine the pleasure of a Jewish mother to see her oldest son Aharon become the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. To see Moshe, her youngest son, the leader of Israel and the best prophet. And then to see her daughter Miriam become the leader of all the women. Who can imagine such maternal pleasure to see all our children successful, all our children productive, all of them great, reaching the highest levels? What a beracha! All of you are Jewish mothers. How much pride do we have when we see our children do the right thing and accomplish things that make us proud? That feeling is indescribable. It puts a smile on our face from the beginning of the day till the end to see our children accomplishing and succeeding. What about Yocheved? To see three children that became the three greatest people that our religion ever produced. Moshe, Aharon, and Miriam. And the Torah spells it out. And I ask you, what zechut did she have to have such children? You need a zechut for such children. What did she do to merit such awesome offspring? Actually, the Torah tells us that answer in the book of Shemot. When Paro made the decree that the midwives in Egypt have to kill all the Jewish children that are being born on the birthing stone, Yocheved was one of the Jewish midwives. She defied Paro's orders. And instead of killing the Jewish children when they were being born, she helped the Jewish mothers give birth, she tended to the children, and she brought life to Am Yisrael. And God said, Yocheved, you aided in bringing Jewish children into the world. You went against Pharaoh's decree, you risked your life to bring children into the world. For that, God said, I am going to give you the most spectacular children. The one that sacrifices for children is blessed with the best of children. But think for a moment. What type of world was Yocheved bringing these children into? It was a miserable world, if you think about it. It was a world of slavery, a world of cruelty and danger and persecution. But still, God says, you brought children, you allowed these children to be born, even though they were born into a very difficult world. Still, the zechut to bring Jewish children into this world is insurmountable. It's so great that no matter what the conditions are, having children is the greatest zechut, even if it's under the greatest pressure. Yocheved wasn't bringing these children into paradise. It wasn't like they were being born into a life of enjoyment where the economy was good and people were making money. These children were being born into slavery. They grew up, they became of age, they had to go work in the fields all day long. But God says the mitzvah of having children is so great, even under all circumstances. I say this because of the enormous responsibility we learn from here to bring children into the world. We live in a country where they're obsessed with family planning. Where the average household in America has 2.5 children and a dog. To have large families is not American. It's not a fashionable thing. Children are a burden. Children limit our ability to enjoy life. We can't travel as much as we'd like to, maybe. We're forced to be homebound. Tuition costs, weddings, all these things deter parents to have children. But today we even have another deterrent. At least these deterrents you could hear, although they're not acceptable. Yocheved gets rewarded for bringing children into the world of Egypt. That cannot compare to any of the pressures that we have here. But today we hear a new claim. That young couples want to live in the city for a few years before they have children. They want to spend some time with each other, go to the theater, go out for dinner. Then, after they finish that stage, now they're ready. Now you're ready. For this, you're delayed having children. It's not a health issue, hospital. If it's a health issue, a competent rabbi is spoken to, and of course there's dispensation. But it's not a health issue over here. It's for pleasure to delay bringing Jewish children into the world so one can prance in Manhattan and live a carefree life, not to be burdened by children, is the most un-Jewish concept. Or young couples give a false claim in many times, in many cases. We're not ready. We're not ready. She's young. She wasn't young enough to get married, to give a ring to raise her brothers and sisters, to be her mother's second helper. But no, she's too young. In some cases this might be true, but unfortunately in many cases it's just another excuse to delay this most important responsibility. The greatness of Yocheved was she brought children into the world even though it wasn't under the best conditions. And God says, Zechut, bring children into the world. Financial pressures are alleviated. With every child there's beracha. With every child the mother gets new strength and new ability. The first mitzvah in the Torah, Peru, Urvu, have children. It's not just one out of 613, it's the first of the 613. And that must tell us that there cannot be Judaism if there are no Jews. The first ingredient for Judaism is you have to have Jews. And the Zohar tells us that there's a certain number of Jews that have to be born before Mashiach comes. And once the last neshama is brought down, then Mashiach can arrive. Hence those that are involved in bringing children into the world are hastening the coming of Mashiach. Every time you hear a good news in the street, she had a boy, she had a girl, you have to know Mashiach is one step closer. But the Zohar writes that right before Mashiach comes, in that last era, there's going to be many multiple births. Why? Because it's going to be at the end of the box. All the neshamot are going to have to come down quickly. So God is going to have to send down two at a time, three at a time, sometimes four at a time. Because Mashiach is at the threshold. And we see this in our time as well. Of course the doctors will say it's because of fertility and it's because of the technology. That's God's angel. The angel of in vitro, or the angel of fertility, that's a malach. In the form of a technology, in the form of a science. Why was it revealed in our generation and not 30 years ago? Because now we're at the threshold of the end. And therefore Borei Olam is bringing this new technology and understanding and medicine in order to bring many children into the world. Just like before we were redeemed from Egypt, the Jewish women were giving birth at six at a time. Multiple births is an indication of redemption. And therefore we must train our children in that thinking. Children are not easy, they're cumbersome, it is a burden to an extent. But it's a mitzvah. And we must fulfill our duty and responsibility. Even at the expense of our own comfort, and even at the expense of our own personal desire, and I say again clearly, we're talking where there's no health issues, and there's no mental concerns, and there's no other issues that are legal. Every case has to be asked and judged and analyzed. This is not a law that can just be said across the board. Of course there are exceptions to the rule, we know that. I'm not talking about the exception case. I'm talking about the general rule. To use comfortability as an excuse to refrain Jewish children from coming into this world is unacceptable. And that was the greatness of Yocheved. And it's my blessing to you ladies today that God should bless you with the same nahat that He gave our ancestor Yocheved. You should seek pleasure from your children like Moshe and Aharon and Miriam. You should derive much nachat from seeing them grow healthily and becoming members of our community that are productive and doing the right things, living according to the values of our Torah. And Be'ezrat Hashem, in the zechut of inspiring others, your children as well as others, to have more children. God will say you are involved in bringing children into the world, whether yourselves or motivating your children or helping others. God will say, you brought children into the world, I will see that your children will be like Moshe and Aharon and Miriam. Shabbat shalom and barakah.